You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Michael Bloomberg has been running New York for the past 12 years, and love him or hate him, the mayor has shaped the city in ways big and small. New Yorker columnist Ken Oletta looks at Bloomberg's legacy and what the billionaire may do after he leaves City Hall in an article called After Bloomberg. It's in the August 26th issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome Ken Oletta back to our show. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. Hi.
You write part of Bloomberg.
I should say good afternoon.
I wasn't going to correct you, but yes. You write, part of Bloomberg's appeal to New Yorkers is that he's perceived as being above the grubbiness of city politics. How has that worked to his benefit over the past 12 years?
Well, I mean, he got a third term. He successfully got the city council and Speaker Quinn to change the law prohibiting three terms for mayor, and he did that in part. It came after the recession of 2008 in preparation for 2009 campaign for governor. And one of the reasons that the council supported that and many civic organizations testified on its behalf was the sense that the mayor was a businessman who would make non-political decisions to right the city and put it upright again.
And then we had that politics as usual kind of approach, although in an earlier time he could have run as many times as he had wished. How long was his lobbying to amend the charter after term limits had been voted in?
Well, it was obviously several years. I mean, because if you remember back in 2001, when after 9/11, Mayor Giuliani tried to amend the limitation so that he could stay in office an extra 6 months. So the law was already in effect in the year 2001, which is when Bloomberg first ran for mayor.
If Bloomberg's been above the fray, he's also never been warm and fuzzy. Many people are turned off by the superior tone he employs when he's addressing criticisms to one of his policies.
No, he is. Part of his appeal to people is that he's not a politician and he speaks his mind. Part of the reason he antagonizes many people is because he speaks his mind and because he says things that seem sometimes to be unhinged from practicality.
Or a little elitist at times.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He is a man very comfortable on the Upper East Side of Manhattan where he resides. And there is a perception. I mean, for instance, I cite the example of the 42-minute speech he made presenting his budget in May, and not once does he mention poverty. And you have a city where 1.7 million people are living on food stamps.
In his first term, he set out to reform schools, and he made a lot of structural changes, including taking over the power to run the public school system from the Board of Education and closing underperforming schools. How successful has his high-profile effort been?
Well, there's no question. There is not a mayoral candidate running who doesn't support mayoral control of the schools. So in that sense, Mayor Bloomberg's victory in gaining control of the Board of Education is supported widely. Where the dispute is how effective he has been in improving education. He can cite many figures. I mean, dropouts are down, graduation rates are up, scores in some, quote, multiple choice or, quote, objective tests are up. But then critics point to the fact that by many other measures, the scores are down. And you still have a tremendously high dropout rate and tremendously high unemployment rate. So it depends on which set of figures you choose to select.
Now, arts education in the city's schools has been seriously cut over the past 12 years, going against state law. He just seems to ignore that fact.
Well, he is, the critics say that he's imperious. And so he does sometimes seem to ignore or actually ignore things that he disagrees with, or insists that he's going to challenge court decisions, be it on stop and frisk or 16-ounce containers for sodas.
Let's talk about stop and frisk for a moment. He often touts his success in cutting crime in the city, and crime has dropped dramatically. many reasons have been given. He is saying that stop and frisk is an important part of that. And how has he responded to, as stop and frisk has become increasingly controversial over the past year?
Well, he said when the judge ruled that stop and frisk violated the law and had to be amended, he said he was going to appeal the decision. The judge was divorced from reality. He passionately believes, as does Police Commissioner Kelly, that stop and frisk is one of the reasons why this year the murder rate in New York will drop to around 300. And, you know, back in the last years of the Dinkins administration, in the early 90s, had a murder rate of 2,000 a year. So under Giuliani, beginning in Dinkins last year, and then under Giuliani and Bloomberg, crime has gone down precipitously, and he has to get some credit for that.
Well, people have also cited demographics and pointed out that stop and frisk turns up very few guns.
No, there's no question. You can marshal evidence. If you want to cite the crime statistics going down and you want to credit stop and frisk for that, you can make a case and marshal that set of facts. If you want to say, well, wait a second, but few guns have been confiscated, and there are a lot of other factors that help explain the drop in crime, you can cite that as well.
Now, he has also been criticized, because he's criticized from left and right. On the right, he's been criticized for creating the equivalent of a nanny state in New York City with a smoking ban in his first term, the calorie counts on menus, most recently attempt to ban large soda sizes. Is that a fair criticism, or isn't the role of a mayor also to use the bully pulpit?
Mayor Bloomberg is not a namby-pamby man. He has, and that comes from his independence and from his business background. He's a man who speaks his mind, and he believes, everyone credits him, including all the mayoral candidates, with being terrific on the public health issue. Now, some people think he's gone too far on things like soda trying to ban 16-ounce sodas. But no one disputes, for instance, that what some would call a nanny position has been wonderful in terms of smoking in New York. It was very unpopular when he introduced it early on, and yet today, much of the rest of the world has followed his lead in trying to ban smoking.
Do these policies play well with upper middle class voters?
I think they do. I mean, if you look at we're talking about upper middle class, we're talking about people approaching wealth or in wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at survey research, Bloomberg tends to do very well among that group of people. He does less well in the working class neighborhoods and where people often feel that he's divorced from them. He has some of the same problems that Mayor Lindsay had, you know, back in the 60s and early 70s, this perception that he was a Manhattan elite liberal.
He is focused on,
if not quite a liberal as Lindsay was, but in some cases a liberal, in some cases just an elite.
Although, interestingly, both of them changed parties a number of times.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bloomberg was a Democrat. He became a Republican to run for mayor the first time, and now is registered as an independent.
And Lindsay started as a Republican and switched to the Democratic Party. Bloomberg focused on some quality of life issues like bike lanes, but then cut services like libraries and arts funding in the schools.
He did, and yet his foundation has obviously generously supported cultural institutions throughout New York. So it's there's no question he's done some things that make him unpopular, and he's done some things that make him wildly popular. And it's like most people after 12 years in office, it's a mixed record.
My guest is Ken Auletta. His article After Bloomberg is in the current issue, the August 26th issue of The New Yorker. Kurt Anderson and I moderated discussion with most of the mayoral candidates about whether 1% of the city's budget could be devoted to support of nonprofit arts institutions in the city, since the arts play such an important role for the city's economy. And none of them were willing to commit as much, but it was pointed out that Bloomberg has cut most support for the arts from the budget, more than any other mayor. In fact, Ed Koch was the last who really was pretty generous. and that he has replaced private philanthropy. But private philanthropy doesn't go to small dance companies, and it doesn't go to local community art galleries and such. So in the end, it really has played a role in hurting a lot of the nonprofit arts institutions in the city.
But, you know, Leonard, one of the problems in New York, and this has been true since the Koch administration, because my first articles for The New Yorker were about Koch, a profile of Ed Koch and a profile of the city's wage structure and union contracts. One of the things that's stunning, if you look at the budget, $6 billion in the current budget goes to pay for health care for employees and their families until they die. $9 billion goes to pay for pensions for people, many of whom retire at the age, you know, after 20 years of service, based on their last year's salary, which is jacked up by overtime. And then the rest, and then a remaining billions of dollars go for fringe benefits. The city estimates that roughly $23 billion goes to pay for pensions, health service, and fringe benefits for city workers. Now, these are hardworking people in many cases, and yet that is more money. That $23 billion is more money than the combined expenditure for police, fire, education, and sanitation. So when you talk about increasing the budget by 1% for art and cultural institutions, which is no doubt a desirable thing to do, one of the reasons you may not be able to do that is because of these incredibly generous benefits we have. And that has to be an issue. And it's not an issue that one should say, well, anyone who takes that position that we should cut some of those expenditures is a conservative or a right-winger. This is a consumer issue. We're all paying for that.
Well, haven't other cities addressed that problem? Bill de Blasio cites Toronto's approach and says that he would try to implement something similar.
But, you know, if you look at health care, I mean, the idea that 95% of city employees, there are almost 300,000, pay zero, not a penny, for their guaranteed health for them and their family. The average city and the average federal employee pays 22% for their health care. So if you want to do comparisons with other governments, New York City has among the most generous, maybe the most generous, health plan of any city in the U.S.
I'm speaking with Ken Oletta. His article after Bloomberg, What Kind of City is the Mayor Leaving to His Successor, is in the August 26th issue of The New Yorker. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ken Oletta, who's a columnist at The New Yorker. His article after Bloomberg, What Kind of City is the Mayor Leaving to His Successor, is in the August 26th issue of that magazine. And if it sounds like I'm picking on the mayor, I'm just trying to go over some of the things, the criticisms that have been lodged against him during these past 12 years. Surprisingly, the people who are running to replace him haven't really been going after him all that strongly.
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, I probably watched or attended about 12 mayoral forums, and I thought they were going after him pretty hard. I mean, obviously Christine Quinn did not go after him hard. I mean, she criticized him on some things, homeless policy, stop and frisk, but essentially she was defending both him and her own record as an incumbent who worked cooperatively with the mayor. But de Blasio and Thompson and the others, I thought they were pretty harsh.
Uh-huh. Well, do you think that's playing well with the public?
In the Democratic primary, yes, absolutely. There's no question. Bloomberg is not. If you disaggregated Democrats from independents and Republicans, Bloomberg would probably not would be below 50% in popularity. But if you throw in independents and Republicans, he would climb above that. I mean, Bloomberg could not make an endorsement in the Democratic primary because it would probably hurt that candidate.
The business,
and they all say that privately.
The business community has loved Bloomberg. Are they worried about who might succeed him?
Oh, there's tremendous fear, and which they expressed to me. But you hear it; it's very common. This concern: will the next mayor be, quote, as they say, anti-business? Will he or she support the kind of economic development policies that have allowed New York jobs to grow 3% above the national average. I mean, those are common expressions of concern. Will the next mayor raise the city income tax, as several have proposed to do? Those are all concerns that the business community expresses. Bloomberg has been an unusually pro-business mayor, and unusual in a city like New York. Usually you become pro-business after you're mayor, not as a campaign issue.
Well, his connections with the world of finance became part of the criticism over how he and Commissioner Kelly responded to Occupy Wall Street.
That is correct. But on the other hand, you know, it took him a long time to... They allowed Occupy Wall Street to occupy Zuccotti Park for a long period of time. But then when they acted, it did obviously arouse some criticism.
Well, earlier there was the matter of jailing of peaceful demonstrators during the Republican convention in 2004.
That is correct.
I suspect he was thinking about that criticism when Occupy took place.
I'm sure that's correct, Leonard.
Now, critics have also pointed to services for the poor, including his plan to fingerprint public housing residents and making access to public assistance harder. Is there a certain tone deafness when it comes to poverty issues?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. You're talking about a man who lives a life divorced from the reality of how many poor people live, and as opposed to someone who's not divorced from the reality of how upper-class people live. So he has blind spots, no question about that.
Income disparity has grown over the last 12 years. There are record numbers of homeless people. Unemployment remains high, although maybe it's a little below the national average. Wages for working and middle-class workers have stagnated. Has the mayor ever had a comprehensive policy to combat poverty? Did he ever talk to you about that?
Well, here's the problem you have. You know, the last mayor who had a comprehensive policy to attack poverty was arguably Robert F. Wagner, and after him, John Lindsay. And the problem is the city doesn't have the resources to attack poverty. Take a look, for instance, Bill de Blasio and John Liu proposed to raise the income tax on the top 1% of earners in New York. What will that raise? In de Blasio's case, it would raise $500 million a year. And in Liu's case, it would raise $1 billion a year. Well, that would not pay for retroactive pay raises for city employees who have not gotten pay raises in several years. So where do you get the funds to attack poverty in New York? You don't. It's really a national budget issue.
Well, the way you're talking, I'm wondering whether the real legacy that Bloomberg passes on might end up being a budget crisis.
Well, there's no question. He has, as I report in my piece, $2.3 billion worth of one-shot revenues that balance the current, his last budget, which started July 1 and goes to June 30, which the new mayor will inherit in January. And so when the new mayor comes time to do his first budget, he faces a one-shot revenue gap of roughly $2.3 billion. Plus, he or she has to decide, do I give retroactive pay raises to city workers? What about new contracts for workers that come due? What do I do? And these are huge issues. I mean, we're talking about if you gave the same 4% raise that city workers got in their last contract as a retroactive raise for those who haven't had a contract increase in several years, you're talking about $7 to $8 billion.
Do you hear that they're waiting to negotiate with Bloomberg's successor? They'd rather do that?
I don't think there's any question that the perception that labor unions have is that they will do better negotiating with the Democrat, and the odds are that who wins the Democratic primary will be the next mayor, than they would do if they negotiate with Bloomberg.
Are any of the candidates talking about how they might balance that first budget?
No. In fact, I interviewed each of them, and I asked them that question. And aside from actually Joe Loder, the Republican, who said he would not give a retroactive pay raise and he would not raise taxes, all the others, you know, just, you know, basically hedged on whether they would give a raise or whether they would give a new contract. And some said, in de Blasio's case and Loder's and John Liu's case, they said they would increase the city income tax, but Quinn and Thompson, you know, kind of fudged on that and said they'd wait and see.
Many people in Brooklyn are concerned about the zoning changes that have encouraged the construction of new high-rises along the waterfront and elsewhere in Williamsburg and Greenpoint to the detriment of the people and businesses that were already located there. There's a piece in today's New York Times about the huge Greenpoint Landing project proposed for the East River waterfront. How does he respond to that criticism?
I think what he would probably say is, look, we've opened up the waterfront. We have made it economically attractive for businesses to locate here, and that's created jobs. And I know there are people who are, if you were honest, I know there are people who feel displaced, who feel this is not in the interest, but I think the greater good has been served. That would be Bloomberg's position.
The greater good, in other words, gentrification or moving...
I think he's a believer in gentrification. He believes that he believes in trickle-down economics, that essentially if you invest and people pay more in taxes, you will have more resources to help the poor. That's his belief.
But businesses
are... A critic can say, sorry.
Go ahead, finish.
No, a critic could say that's Reagan policy. That's trickle-down, traditional conservative trickle-down economics.
But in building some of these high-rises, a lot of new construction, we are also forcing businesses to go out of business. Is that good economic policy?
Well, the argument is you're talking about small businesses.
Small businesses, garages, auto repair shops, whatever, businesses that were serving their communities and were providing jobs for people in that community, now all replaced by cookie-cutter high-rises.
This is the argument that goes back to Jane Jacobs, where she would argue that Robert Moses policies and development policies of the city back in the 50s and 60s were displacing people and replacing ma-and-pa stores and people sitting on their stoops with big high-rise apartments and supermarkets. And what she called the eyes on the street, which helped reduce crime, disappeared into these public houses. And the argument against it that the Moses and other people made is that you're giving housing, subsidized housing to people, more housing, and you're creating more jobs. That's an age-old argument.
Yeah, but as I understand it, post Robert Caro's books, Moses lost and Jane Jacobs won. And now it looks like Mayor Bloomberg is playing the Robert Moses role?
Well, I wouldn't say he's playing the Robert Moses role. I think he's been a lot more sensitive than Robert Moses and more liberal than Robert Moses, actually. But, Jane Jacobs won and things like Westway were defeated, no question. But she lost in a lot of neighborhoods were bulldozed in the Bronx and Manhattan, Lower East Side, etc.
My guess is Ken Auletta. His article after Bloomberg, "What Kind of City Is the Mayor Leaving to His Successor," is in the August 26th issue of The New Yorker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You said the mayor hasn't endorsed anyone. What has he said about the race to succeed him?
Well, he's tried to mute his public comments on that. He has criticized the candidates for what he calls trying to placate special interests. And has criticized some of their stances, certainly their stance in regard to stop and frisk or raising, the city income tax. But essentially, he has refrained from making an endorsement, and he will not make an endorsement, I believe, before the Democratic primary. But his people who I spoke to, his close political advisors, think it is possible if some candidates, particularly the most liberal candidates who he would consider Bill de Blasio as the foremost one. If he were nominated, it is not inconceivable that Bloomberg would then try and endorse Joe Lota, the Republican, whose positions are more consonant with the mayor's than de Blasio's.
Now, the mayor is reported to have tried to convince Ray Kelly to run, and Ray Kelly refused to consider it, even though the mayor paid privately for a poll that indicated that Kelly would have had a chance.
Yeah, I reported that in my New Yorker piece, and in fact, Kelly supposedly people close to the mayor say came in first in that poll. But Kelly wasn't, you know, wasn't about to do that, I suspect, for a complex set of reasons, including the fact that, you know, he wants to earn some money. And also, you know, as one of the mayor's advisors said to me, the best day of Ray Kelly's campaign would have been the day he announced. And after that, it would start to go downhill because he's not an experienced politician. And you tend to have foot and mouth disease when you're not.
Now, what's next for him? First of all, he's pretty much disassociated himself from the corporation that made him rich. Do you think he'll go back to it?
No, he says he won't. He says he won't spend full time on that or on his foundation. He doesn't know what he's going to do, he says. He says he'll take 2 weeks vacation, 1 week to play golf, 1 week to ski. And he said after that he would go crazy if he spent any more time. He's got about 12 homes around the world and around the U.S., and he's going to wrestle with it. I mean, his company would love to buy the Financial Times, as I report. He refused to confirm, but I think he would enjoy the challenge, though it is not for sale, of buying the New York Times and the platform that would give him as publisher.
And that would give him a platform that he can't get with Bloomberg.
I think, I mean, he does have, because he's Mike Bloomberg, because he gives so much money, he does have, you know, a worldwide platform where people, you know, invite him to Brazil or Russia or other places to speak, and be it on smoking or the environment or how to run a city, and he funds many mayoral programs around the country and around the world. So he has a platform. But I think if you're talking about and you know, obviously he supports and opposes people with his own money who are opposing gun control, let's say. But is that as big a platform as, say, Bill Clinton has? No, it's not.
Ken Auletta's article, After Bloomberg, What Kind of City is the Mayor Leaving to His Successor?, is in the August 26th issue of The New Yorker. And we have a link to it, I think. That you can find that on our show page at WNYC.org. Ken, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Leonard. Thank you.